It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. I hope you're doing well, staying healthy. Really excited about tonight's show. And in just a little bit, in just a few minutes, a shakeup of our normal rundown, we're going to be talking to Sadiqua Johnson about this fabulous book, Yellow Wife. And Sadiqua, I'm not going to make you talk yet, but I want you to see what I have in my hands, which is the drink that goes along with your book. It's a really amazing book, a very difficult book in many ways, but amazing. Right now, we have award-winning Claude Jennings doing all the important work, David Aldred zooming in, and Erica Wright, one of our favorite Chatter on Books authors, alums. Erica, welcome back. How are you doing?
Thank you.
How is life with a one-year-old? What are you working on?
Fun. I was thinking that at the end of the day, I'm exhausted, but in the same way that you would be exhausted after a hike or doing something that you really enjoy. So one has been fun. One is a good age.
Wow.
I recommend it.
Yeah, man, it changes.
Yeah, it doesn't get easier. I probably told the story on this show once or twice before, but when our kids were little, like three toddlers, I was talking to my mother on the phone. She raised five girls. And I just said, I was just, you know, worn out. And I said, I just think when they get a little bit older and a little bit more independent, this is going to be so much easier. And there's this long pause and then kind of hysterical laughter on her part. And she says, you think this gets easier? We are going to shake up the normal routine here, because normally we make our featured authors listen to 10 or 15 minutes of sports talk, but we won't do that. We got the Super Bowl out of the way, but we are going to do a couple of things. And one is we have to do the weekly tribute to Dolly Parton. David, would you like to say the latest about what Dolly Parton is up to? The goddess, the official goddess
This is about her employees at Dollywood.
Yes.
Dollywood, Dolly World.
Yes.
I'm not sure which one it is.
Dollywood.
I mean, she's paying their tuition, basically, if they want to go to school.
Free tuition for and books and other expenses for any employee, part-time, full-time.
Doesn't matter.
If you're brand new on the job, if you've been there for 10 years, covers everybody.
Yeah.
Which is just amazing. And then pretending this is about books, which it is, because she's a book goddess. She's got her book coming out on March 6th, the one she's doing with James Patterson.
Oh, the mystery, the combo. Yeah.
Run, Rose, Run. So evidently the story is James Patterson went to see her and said, let's write a book together or whatever. And she said, great idea. And this is all he does now. He writes books with other people. And he says, great idea. 2 days later, she meets with him again and comes up with seven songs that she's written to go along with the book, which will be released evidently at the same time as the book. So the pitch is on now to get her on the show.
There you go.
But in the meantime, Sadiqua, I know we have to get you out in about 25 minutes and there's so much we want to cover, but thank you for joining us and thank you for writing this remarkable book.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I love this back and forth between different hosts. I feel like I'm a part of a big family right now.
Yeah,
that's what we are. And then half the family usually drinks.
I'll just say that.
So, David, you've missed this. And I will, I don't want to start off Sadiqua. We'll come to this, but this is the official drink of Sadiqua's book, Yellow Wife. So, Sadiqua, a little bit on your backstory. You worked for an agency that represented authors. So you got to work for big time authors?
Yeah, no, I actually worked at two different publishing houses. My first job out of college was at Scholastic Books. So I was in children's publishing. And so I had the great pleasure to work with J.K. Rowling, author of Harry Potter. I worked with Walter Dean Myers. I worked with Ruby Bridges. So I had a really good first foot into publishing prior to becoming an author. And then I left Scholastic and I went to Putnam and I worked with adult books. And so there I did Amy Tan and Catherine Coulter and Nevada Barr. I know. I was like with all these New York Times bestselling authors early, early on in my career.
Wow, that's awesome.
And what did you learn from them?
I learned a lot. I mean, I would pick their brains. You know, this was back before COVID. So we had the pleasure of writing in town cars with them to the Today Show and Good Morning America. And so it was just us. And I would ask questions like, what's your writing schedule like? How did you get an agent? You know, where do you get your ideas? How much time do you write each day? And they were always so gracious and so happy to share information with me. So I soaked it up.
Did you notice, were there any generalizations you could make between the male authors and the female authors? And something, Erica, you can speak to this, something we've talked about before. A lot of our authors that we've had on the show, the women are moms and they're doing 14,000 things and the writing becomes almost a marginal exercise, sort of on the margins of their life. They do this. But did you notice any difference working with these famous authors, male versus females, in terms of how they worked about the process?
Wow, that's really a good question. And now it's coming back to me that I do remember I had this one author, and this was before I had kids. So I didn't even know enough to be sympathetic to what she was going through. And like Erica, she had a young child and she was flying across the country and they needed to make all these book stops. And we were figuring out car seats and this, that, and the other. And me as a young person without kids, my thought was, why are you even bringing the child with you? Like, just go to work, you know? But now on the other side, I have three kids myself. I see, you know, what it's like to be with your kids and need to have your kids around and your kids need to have you around. And, you know, I have a total different perspective because back then I was like, what is the deal? Like, just leave the baby home.
Erica, remind us, how do you work it out? Because 1 year olds nap, but they don't nap on a great schedule. You have to be available. So how's it working out for you?
You know, I was just actually talking to my students about how I've had to shift because I used to love to get up early in the morning, make my cup of tea. I haven't had a warm cup of tea. Even this tea I'm having right now is cold, and this is all I'm doing. I don't know how. What I found is I do a lot more work in my head, which I never did before. I love to noodle. I love to play. And now I feel like I have to sort of create a lot of scenes and things in my head. And then when I do have the time, get them out as quickly as possible. So that shifted significantly.
Are you able to remember them? Because when my kids were small, heck, and now I can live in an old age. When my kids were small, you'd be doing 15 things and I'd have some great thought in my head. And then 20 minutes later, I'd go, what was it? What was that great idea? I just forget.
Well,
do you write
it
down? What do you do?
The other night as I was falling asleep, I thought this is a great poem title. And I never do this, but I was like, I'm going to get up and write it down because I'll forget it. And then I looked at it in the morning and the poem title was Winter.
Brilliant.
It's still brilliant. Great. Still great. I mean, it's not bad.
Terrible. But maybe I would have enjoyed that extra 5 minutes of sleep.
Good for you. Okay, Sadiq, let's talk about this awesome book, Yellow Wife. And the backstory of how you were inspired to write this book is fascinating. It's probably the most interesting one we've had. So can you share that about how you came about with the idea? Award-winning before this book, but my understanding was you were trying to figure out what's next, and then you tell the story.
Yeah, absolutely. So I moved to the Richmond area in 2015. There was no real reason why I moved here. It felt like a calling. You know, I was standing in my kitchen in Springfield, New Jersey, and I heard this voice that said, move. And I told my husband, and we both worked for ourselves, so it wasn't a hard thing. So we moved. This was February of 2015, and we were all moved in by June of 2015. And I couldn't figure out why things flowed so easily. Why were we here? What were we supposed to be doing? Well, 9 months later, I had some friends come down from New Jersey and we were looking for an activity that we could do with their kids and our kids. Mm-hmm. And someone suggested that we take a walk on the Richmond Slave Trail. And the Richmond Slave Trail was put into place in 2011. There's 17 markers along the trail and it details what it was like for the enslaved people as they came into Richmond. Richmond being number two on the slave trading business slot behind New Orleans. So there's a lot of history here. You got to dig around for it, but there's a lot of history. And the kids took turns reading the different marker. And I remember we got to the marker that talked about the Lumpkins Jail. And it was described as a punishing center and holding site for enslaved people. The owner of the jail was married to a Black woman and her name was Mary Lumpkin. And while he was the devil, was one of his nicknames, he was also called the bully trader. And this was the devil's half acre. He was described as being kind and considerate to Mary and their five children. But he was one way. He was a different way. He was mean. He was vindictive. He was evil in business. And I kept wondering what life was like for Mary Lumpkin. We know women like her didn't have a lot of agency over their lives. And so was this a marriage of survival? You know, did she love him? And what did she tell those five children on a daily basis? And that was kind of that first little nugget that kind of got into my skin. And I felt this energy that said, Sadiqua, you need to be paying attention right now.
And tell us about the research you did.
So we skipped ahead on the trail and we went to the Sacred African Burial Ground. Yeah. And that was kind of when the story really kind of got into my skin. And I figured out I needed to know more about our ancestors, about the people who lived in Virginia, specifically the enslaved people. So I grabbed my two daughters. At the time, they were really young. I think they were like in third and fifth grade, I think, at the time. And I took them to the one of the plantations in Charles City, Virginia. And we went on the tour. I'm the type of writer, I need to smell it, taste it, touch it, breathe it, feel it, get it all in my skin. So that was the beginning. It was going to plantations. Then it went into me going to the libraries and getting periodicals and reading different novels and textbooks about enslaved people in Richmond.
Wow. Describe the scene of the Devil's Half Acre, of this jail, because I think most people, not having read this book, and this is another one of the books that I found myself reading and then looking things up and finding more pictures and more illustrations, and the illustration of what the Devil's Half Acre looked like is pretty remarkable. But a half acre is not a lot of land. And describe what all went on in this half acre and in the book.
Yeah, half acre is not a lot of land. And on this half acre, specifically in the city, right? So my first introduction and what I knew about slavery particularly took place on plantations. It was like the movie and the book's Root. You know, there was a scary overseer who was wretched to the people and they were afraid. But this was my first introduction to slavery in the city. And so the Devil's Half Acre was a half acre of land. There was the jail, which was the holding site and the slave pen. People were crammed in bodies tightly. It was rarely cleaned. It smelled horrific. You could smell it for blocks and blocks away from the actual jail. There was a tavern on the property where he entertained, Robert Lumpkin entertained his guests. There were slave auctions there. It was where he did his business. That was also a hotel connected to the tavern. There was the house in which Mary raised their five children and they lived in together. There was the kitchen house. And then there were some smaller outhouses. So everything pretty much happened within eye radius. I mean, and I think that's what really drew me to the story, is that I was really curious about those children, what life was like for them. What did Mary tell them on a daily basis? How did she reckon with being a part of his business, but also trying to survive at the same time? Because she was an enslaved woman and these were her fellow enslaved people that she was coming in contact with on a daily basis.
It did seem as though every day she was faced with making incredibly tough choices and making, it's almost a bad pun, you know, a pact with the devil on a daily basis. But it was about survival, right? For herself, for her family, for other people that she cared about. What do you think it was about her? What did you learn about her that got her through that? What got her through making those tough choices every day?
She didn't have a choice. I mean, she really literally did not have a choice. Every day it was survive or die, survive or be injured, survive or be hurt, survive or lose someone who you cared about, survive or lose your children. You know, so she didn't have a choice. And that was the thing that I learned about our ancestors, was that, you know, they knew how to make a way out of no way because they didn't have a choice.
Yep. One of the things that struck me, and again, I just spent half my time researching while I was reading the book, because it was so fascinating, but you describe in really, really brutal detail of what went on in the Devil's Half Acre and the kind of sadistic nature that Robert Lumpkin, the jailer, brought to the experience of these poor people. Was it hard for you to write that? Was it hard for you to write some of those scenes that were so brutal and so tough?
It's harder for me to read those scenes, meaning as I'm doing my research and finding out that these things actually happened to our ancestors, This is not a figment of my imagination. It's not something I made up. You know, for the most part, most of those harrowing scenes I found in a textbook, I found in slave narratives, and I took them and turned it into fiction. And so I would say it's harder for me to learn it than it is to write it, because when I was writing it, I felt charged with giving a voice to those who never had a voice. It felt like a calling to bring their stories to light and kind of give them their just due. And so that didn't hurt as badly as discovering the fact that this had happened.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite reviews was the NPR review, and they raved about the book. And they said, you know, there's tragedy and there's this horror, but there's also some joy. And there did seem to be that in her life, especially when she could spend the time she wanted with her children. One of the things that really struck me throughout it was the piano playing. Can you explain that?
Yeah. So that was not planned in my original synopsis of the story. Certain things just kind of creep into the story. So her playing piano creeped into the story, the whole diary that creeped into the story. That was not a part of my original plan. But for me, I think I am drawn to music just in general. And so I live vicariously through my characters. So for instance, Ruth, her mother, was a medicine woman. You know, she knew how to mix herbs and how to cure people. And while I can't do any of that, I think if I had been born in a different time period, that's something that I would have known how to do. And the same thing with Phoebe as a piano player. For me, as I'm listening, all of my books always have a soundtrack. And so as I'm listening to music in the background, sometimes for me, typing is almost like playing piano. There is a dance that I'm doing with the music and the typewriter. And well, I don't use a typewriter, but the computer. I should pretend like I use a typewriter. That makes me sound really cool. But,
very cool.
You know, there's a dance, you know, that I'm doing with the keyboard and the music and the characters. And I'm in this portal. I'm in this rhythm. And so it was a natural thing. I knew that in the 1800s, there was not a lot of entertainment. And so one of the things that people did and they taught other people to do was play piano. And so that really fit very nicely with the story. That was totally fictional. I am not sure if Mary Lumpkin played the piano or not.
Oh, it was wonderful. Okay, David, I saw you shaking your head up and down. Yes. Do you listen to music when you're working? I can't imagine you do. But do you feel like there's a rhythm going on when you're flying across the keyboard?
Yes, absolutely. When you're really riffing and it's really coming to you and it's flowing, it's improvisation. It's like Tori hates jazz.
Oh no.
But
go ahead.
That's exactly what it's like. You're just kind of riffing and you're just going with it. You're not fighting it. You're kind of just saying, okay, let's see where this goes and how far can I take this? And it doesn't mean you like everything that you write, but you want to you respect the process of creation. And when that kind of spasm is done, you go back and look at it and say, okay, is this, what can I take from this? You don't take everything.
This is great. Erica, does music literally or metaphorically speaking play a role when you write?
No, I have a hard time listening to music and writing. I love that idea. I feel like I'm nodding yes because it sounds so lovely to have this writing dance. But no, I find I'm sort of before I had a child, I'm a no distractions writer. I like it to be nice and quiet. A little city noise is okay. But beyond that, everything's sort of shut off, including usually the Wi-Fi. Everything's kind of, I try to make it a little cave.
Right.
Yeah. Turning off the Wi-Fi actually is a really good idea, because I don't know if this is true for you all, but for me, the distraction of email and the fact that my text messages can pop up on my computer at any time and totally ruin the flow is dangerous for me.
It's a good idea. I like that idea.
Yeah.
Never thought about that.
I use this little app on my phone called Forest, and it grows these little magical trees, these little, so you can use your phone, but if you do, you kill the tree, you kill the little fake tree.
Nice.
Actually, it's a nice compromise, because if, you know, my mom calls, I pick up, but otherwise, you know, I let my little forest grow.
That's nice. Yes, David, please.
Yeah. It's a wonderful book. It's really wonderful. And I hate to say, it's a wonderful book about a terrible, terrible, terrible time. I have two questions, actually. One is, you write about color in this book, And this is something that Black people talk about all the time. White people never don't have no idea what we're talking about when we start talking about color. But it's such a central part to the book. And I just wondered, at what point did you go, yeah, I'm just going to go there. We're just going to this is going to be out. And this is going to be a big part of this book.
Wow, that's such a good question. Because it was never a decision. It was the story that needed to be written. It was never anything that I decided. When I learned of Mary Lumpkin, the thing that I knew about her was that she was referred to by Robert Lumpkin as his yellow wife. So I knew that she was light skinned. She was also referred in other passages as the yellow woman. And so I knew that she was mulatto. I knew that her father was most likely the master of somebody's plantation. And so right away, I knew she was a mulatto girl going in. And I knew that that was going to be a central theme throughout the story, because the things that happened to Mary Lumpkin, the things that happened to Phoebe Dolores Brown in the story would not have happened had she not been light skinned. Right. And there would be no way to tell the story another way. So it was never really a conscious decision. It was just the way the story needed to be told.
There's a scene a little more than midway through the book where there's a dinner where there's lots of mulatto women there. And it just blew me away. I was like, I never even considered that this actually happened, that this they may have talked about this, and how could they possibly talk about this with anybody else? Right. Like, it just blew me away. It was such a great scene. It was wonderful.
Well, I have to tell you, I'm really glad you appreciated that scene, because that scene, I can't even tell you how many drafts it took. And I can't tell you how many times my editor came back and she was like, I need you to do this. I need you to do that. This is missing. And so that scene was worked several drafts. And I think it comes up a lot in conversation. And I think that's why. So drafting, if there's any writers out there listening, drafting is such an important part of the writing process. You know, I have to tell my kids all the time, you don't just write a paper and turn it in. Like, you write the paper, you let it sit, you let it marinate, you go back to it, you rethink it, you rewrite it, you know? And so editing is such a major part of writing for me. And I actually retype whole scenes sometimes until I get it right, because the retyping, it does something different for me.
That's fast. Erica, you're nodding your head yes. You agree? Drafting, redrafting?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Redrafting. No, what I was thinking in my head was, I'm going to play this for my students. So this was not just me giving this advice. Sadiqa says so as well.
Yep. Sadiqa, can you talk about Phoebe's daughters?
Yeah, so like in respect of what happens to them as the story progresses?
I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is what I'll do. I'll talk about Mary Lumpkin's daughters. So I knew of Mary Lumpkin was that she inherited the jail when Robert Lumpkin died in 1865, and he willed the jail and his fortune and his real estate to her. She was walking through the streets of Richmond, and she was introduced to a Baptist minister. His name was Nathaniel Culver, and he was looking for a space where he could rent out so that he could teach the freemen how to read and to write and religion. And so they made a deal. So she leased the Devil's Half Acre to him. They removed the chains and the whips and everything out of the jail, and it became a school. It was replaced with desks and chairs. So it went from being the Devil's Half Acre to God's Half Acre. And so it had a redemptive quality. That school changes hands a couple of times, changes names a few times, but now it is Virginia Union University, which is still in Richmond today, which was one of the first HBCUs in the country. Mary Lumpkin, she goes to Philadelphia for a little while. She goes down to New Orleans. She has one daughter with her as she's traveling. Two of her daughters go up to Ipswich, Massachusetts, where they pass for white. And so they sort of disappear from the history books because they changed names and they really disassociated themselves from their family completely, because to be found out that you're passing is, you know, punishable by law. And so they change their name, they disappear, and they move away from the history books. Mary Lumpkin and the one daughter, they open up a restaurant, and then they end up in New Richmond, Ohio, where she dies in 1902.
Wow, amazing. Okay, going back to Robert Glumpkin, the jailer in the book, Phoebe's husband, these unspeakable acts, just absolutely unspeakable acts. But then he'd have these moments of almost generosity or kindness. So for instance, he didn't have to leave that to her when he died. He could have done lots of different things. He could not have been kind to their children, but he was in many ways. And I found myself, when I was reading the book, resenting it and being angry every time he did something that somebody would characterize as kind. Did you have any kind of conflicts as you were writing his scenes?
He was the most difficult character to write. And in fact, yeah, the notes that kept coming back from my agent prior to even selling the book to Simon & Schuster was that he was one-dimensional, that he had to be a wow, man of two faces, that he had to be three-dimensional. And so finding a way to toe that line where he was kind and compassionate or considerate in some ways, but horrific and the devil, but then walking that line where you just never knew which side of him you were going to get, you know, it again took a lot of spending time with him, spending time in those scenes, really trying to figure out what his nuances were, what things made him tick, really getting to know his character. Character, yeah, for me drives the story, right? And so once I could figure out all those things, I could push the story along a little bit faster and easier.
I found myself trying to put myself in your shoes. Completely ridiculous, I know. As you were writing this, I'm thinking, wow, when she wrote that scene about him doing something horrific, you couldn't go to bed at night. You'd have to just stay up all night and then find something else better to write. That was awful. I'm going to be really respectful of our time here. I want to get you out with this. You dedicate this wonderful book, Yellow Wife, to your family. And it says, let me get it exactly right. It says, for my beloved children, Miles, Zora, and Lena Johnson, to know where you're going, you must understand from whence we came. And also your husband.
My husband gets every book, but that's the first time the kids got a book.
Nice. So, A, what did they think about having it dedicated to them? And have they learned from the book? What did they think of the book?
Okay, so first, what did they think about having it dedicated? They complained that it was dedicated to all three of them, as opposed to just one person getting a full book to
awesome,
themselves. So
awesome,
that. So they did not good, appreciate my, you know, good, my heart.
That's why you're going to have to book, write at least three more books, so each one can have their own.
Yeah. Can have their own book. You know, I think that they are really proud of the work that I've done with Yellow Wife and the way my career has grown because of it. My middle daughter, she's 16, and I had a big event in Richmond a couple of months ago, and there were like over 300 people in the audience. And she said, Mommy, when I walked in, because it was a theater, she said, I thought that there was a play going on, like in the next room. And then I walk into the theater and I look around and like all these people are here for you. And I remember like months ago, we went to an event and it was like three people showed up. And she said, wow, you know? And so I think that they could see the progression of, you know, my first novel, I was a self-published author. And so I literally was standing at book festivals with retractables and tables and my book, hand selling my book, to her walking into a theater and there are 300 people there to hear me talk about Yellow Wife. And so I definitely feel like they are very proud of the success, and they've been with me the whole way.
Nice. Very, very nice. Erica, your one-year-old soon, very soon, will have that kind of appreciation. Sadiqa Johnson, the book is fabulous. Yellow Wife. Thank you for writing it. I can't
awesome,
imagine it was
great
easy,
great
but thank
book,
you for writing it. And thank you for being with us. And I hope you stay healthy and keep writing and come back to see us again.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. And I enjoy being a part of this lovely family just for the time that we were together. So thank you.
Great. Thank you. Take care. It's fabulous. David, you've just blown my mind that you have a jazz-like experience when you're writing, my friend.
Oh, sure. Because just I respect the whole idea that within structure, there's structure in jazz. I know people
right,
don't believe this, but there actually is structure in jazz. But within that structure, people are allowed to kind of improvise and kind of work with each other in real time. And that's what makes the alchemy so special to me, is that they're doing it as they're doing it. You know, it's not like they sat down and had a seminar about it. They just kind of figure it out. So that to me is what writing is. It's a structure with freedom inside that structure.
Erica, does that sound right?
That's what I love about forms in poetry. The idea that, you know, if you have a sonnet, you know, you're limited to 14 lines. If you're using form, there are even more restrictions. But then you get to play within the form. So that I can relate to that, even though I don't, I need to have a distraction-free writing environment.
I love it. One-year-old distraction-free doesn't happen. Okay, Erica, now we can kind of reverse, flip back to the top of the show. What are you working on? What's the next great book you're writing about? Have you been hanging out with snakes lately? And I read somewhere recently, you're now buying just hardcover books?
I've been buying a lot of hardcovers. Yeah, I've moved quite a few times. And every time I move, I donate a bunch of books. And what I've noticed is that, you know, when paperbacks hit about that 10-year mark, they're really just not holding up. They're not looking their best. So I have been transitioning to hardcovers because they seem to last a lot longer. And I like them as sort of beautiful, beautiful objects.
David, hardcover, paperback, which for you?
You know, I, unfortunately, I do a lot of reading on my Kindle. I mean, I love hardbacks and paperbacks, but I was just talking about this with my wife. We're out of room. We have no more room in our house and the books are piling up and, you know, we can't really build another shelf. You know, I don't want to get an IKEA stupid shelf. I had those when I was younger. Right. I won't do that anymore. So I'm not sure what to do because I love hardcover books and I'd like to get more of them, but I have nowhere to put them right now. So I don't want to get rid of any of my books. I love all my books and I don't want to donate any of them because I'm selfish.
Yes. And though you have to, so I've gone through this recently and our children are never going to have bookshelves. When we look at our house, we've got bookshelves everywhere. Our kids are never going to own homes that have bookshelves because they don't read real books. If they read, it's on a Kindle, it's on their phone or whatever. But you have to take the Marie Kondo approach to books, David.
Yes.
And you have to put your hands on it. This takes time. And you have to say, okay, does this book, when I see it, does it still bring me joy? Am I still happy to see it? And do I want to see it on my bookshelf? Is this something I'd like to share with somebody else? Because you can give them to people.
Yes.
I find myself often, I'll have a conversation with someone out walking the dogs, wherever, and they'll be talking about something. They go, oh my God, I've got a great book for you. And I run it over later in the day. You know, is this one I could give away to somebody that I know who would appreciate it or donate it? And there I've been shocked in the last few weeks that we've been getting rid of hundreds and hundreds of books, but there are plenty of libraries. There are plenty of charities that are signed up with Salvation Army, Purple Heart, et cetera, that do still want real books because people do want to read them. And so there are homes for them.
All right.
Yeah, homes for them. Okay. All right. So in my time zone, which is 2 hours ahead of you guys, it's still Valentine's Day.
Where are you?
So, okay. You can't see. You see that window back there?
Uh-huh.
You can't see out that because it's all cloudy and rainy, but we're in Patagonia. We're in very southern Argentina.
Jesus.
And
why are you doing this show? What is the matter with you?
On Valentine's Day in Argentina. Let me do my books.
My show. Because I love this show. I love doing this show. And the bartender upstairs was really happy to be making a drink. And he asked for the name of it. And he's now officially adding it to the repertoire of the bar at this lodge where we're staying. But anyways, it's Valentine's Day. And Brian and I were talking earlier today. We have spent now 30 Valentine's Days together.
Wow.
Yep. David, how many for you and Diane?
34. Well, woo! I mean, you'd be physically together or just since we've been together?
Yeah, since you've been together.
Yeah. Well, 35 actually this year. 35.
There you go. Okay. Claude, how many with the better half?
14. 14. Yep.
Child. Erica?
I'm like Claude. I would have to do the math, but I think it's 14 or 15.
Wow. It's so adorable. It's so adorable. Of course, Brian and I also always say, we had a big party for our 25th wedding anniversary. And people go, oh, it's so great. It's so wonderful, whatever. And did you ever imagine it? We'd go, nope. And if you had asked us 1992 when we got married, he's sitting about 4 feet away, by the way, but fortunately has his earbuds in so he can hear this. But if you had asked us in 1992 when we got married, you know, do you guys see yourselves 30 years from now, 40 years from now? Not a chance. But we are. Okay.
Anyway, if David and Erica celebrate Valentine's Day at all.
Do we celebrate Valentine's Day? I'm taking my wife out when we're done, when the show is done.
Nice. Where are you going?
We're going to a restaurant.
Oh, that's right. We didn't want to tell people because they might all show up. Erica, is there time to celebrate in your household?
We've never really celebrated Valentine's Day. It's not a day I enjoy going out. It's usually, you know, cold out. I don't want to get dressed up. I just want to keep my pajamas on. But one year, my husband was going out of town. I think it was a work trip or something. I did not know it was Valentine's Day, but he came home on Friday with flowers and a what I call a guilt cake. He brought me a cake and I thought, yeah, this I'm into. I will take guilt cake any weekend he wants to drop off a red velvet cake because he's going to be out of town. I'm all in favor of.
Oh, that's fabulous. My parents were married for 9 zillion years and literally for over 60 years. And every year on Valentine's Day, they did not travel much. My dad would bring my mother a box of Russell Stover's, a heart-shaped box of Russell Stover's chocolate every single year. Never missed. Never missed. That's amazing. Okay. But in honor of Valentine's Day, I started Googling best romance novels, top 10 romance novels, all these kinds of things. And according to famousauthors.org, the most famous, better than all others, romance novels, and no particular, and this, I'll just do the top five: Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, mm-hmm. Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte, Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte, in the same year, by the way, 1847 came out, Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy, and Gone with the Wind by Margaret Mitchell. Erica, agree, disagree, have others?
Well, Jane Eyre is one of my reread books, one of those ones I actually enjoy rereading. So for me, it stands up on that list. You know, I was thinking, you're always so nice to send us this question beforehand, so I get to ruminate a little bit. But Love in the Time of Cholera is a book I've been thinking about a lot recently, probably because we're in a pandemic.
Right.
But also, I read that book 20 years ago, and I still remember some specific romantic scenes in that book. So I think it's missing. I'm going to say it's missing from that list.
Okay. David?
I am such a short material. I'm not a... I don't read romance novels. I'm sorry. I like, you know, movies where people shoot and stab and connive. And
yeah. One of the things I was struck by, and I looked up other lists because there are so many
different.
I did
see Love Story, though, the movie with Ryan O'Neal, and that was really well done. Yeah.
That got number seven.
Number seven. Yes. I did not read the Eric Segal book, but I saw the movie.
And I think I read the book just because when the movie came out. But one of the things that I was struck by is that with the exception of Outlander, which is number 8, 1991, and The Notebook, 96, and Time Traveler's Wife, 2003. So the top 5 or 6 don't even break 1960. These books have been around for a long time. And they did, not in the exact same order, but a lot of these books would come up on the other list. And I thought, wow, what is it about these that has some lasting value? Because they're not for me. I mostly hated the top 3 because my older sisters loved them. So anything my sisters loved, I'd say, got to be awful. And by the way, I think it was the cause of a lot of their problems. They read too much fiction when they were young, and they would read these books like Pride and Prejudice, or they would read, and they would think, oh, it's all going to work out for me. So I hate those. But the one, I kind of think of great romance novels have great love stories in them. And I think one of the greatest love stories, stay with me here, is in Don Quixote. And it's Don Quixote and Dulcinea. Mm-hmm. And he sees past everything because he's in love with her, and he will do anything, no matter what. And I just think that's one of the greatest love stories of all time. So I thought it should have been on the list. Okay. That's it. Oh, it's all we've got. I'm kind of out of sync here because we've reversed order on everything.
I know.
But Erica, what's coming up? What should we be looking forward from you?
Well, my agent has my new novel right now. It's a retelling of Measure for Measure, which is not a romance, set in a snake-handling Pentecostal church in West Virginia. So this kind of insular community.
Excellent. The snakes make a comeback.
We'll see. We'll see if it finds a home.
Oh,
they do. I promise my agent that is the last. That is the last of the snake books, but we'll see if I if I can keep to that promise.
So great. Okay, so your child gets, you know, is 4 or 5 years old, and says, wants to have a snake, what do you do?
You know, snakes, I don't think that snakes want to be pets. You know, I think that my beagle, I think, really enjoys being a pet. She is committed to the role. She shows up every day and does her best work, A-plus work. But I don't think snakes really want to be pets. So I think that's what I would explain. They want to be free. They want to be wild.
Yeah, and then your child would see them in a store and say, no, we should take them out of that store. We should give them a better life. I think this is going to be great. I think Chatter a few years now is going to give your child a snake as a gift. Okay, everybody. We are back next week with Xochitl Gonzalez, who has written Olga Dies Dreaming, which is this fabulous book, one of Ron Charles' favorites. So we're looking forward to that. In the meantime, download us, review us kindly. Next week, I'll read some reviews. We've gotten a couple of the nice ones, which is nice because they're now when I type in Apple iTunes and reviews, the bad one isn't near to the top. It's kind of getting pushed down. So that makes me very happy. So thank you for that, people.
Thank
we'll
you
read
all
some next week.
All our chatterers who listen and tune us in every week. It's fantastic.
Tune us in every week. It's fun. It's a family. Someone let's see, who said quite the family? Kevin says quite the family, although a little dysfunctional.
Yeah, that's about right.
There we go. Okay. I see some of these. I'm going to follow up on Rob on the Alzheimer's Society. That'll be great. Mm-hmm. Claude, thank you for making everything happen, my friend. Mm-hmm. Erica, thank you for joining us. Hope you get some sleep. David, enjoy
like
Cleveland.
Thank you.
We might not see you next week, right?
May not.
David, because you'll be in Cleveland?
I'll be in Cleveland watching really, really, really bad All-Star game, but that's really good.
But then we'll have something sporty to talk about.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, everybody. Happy Valentine's Day. Thank you and stay well. We're out.